Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. Welcome to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and across Asia and the Pacific on Radio Australia. A little later today, the music rangers of the Australian desert. They're charged with nurturing a new sound from the indigenous communities, fostering the talent there, and also caring for the instruments. We'll have more on how the program works a little later today, and we'll also bring you some of the new music that it's helped to create. That's all coming up. Stay with us on Bush Telly. First today, could more Australian jobs be lost to New Zealand? New Zealand is already outperforming Australia when it comes to food manufacturing. Just look at Heinz and McCain's, two food giants that have shut down plants in Australia and shifted them across the Tasman. And if you were listening on Friday, you would have heard the managing director of Simplot, the vegetable food processor, Terry O'Brien, talking about its future, Simplot tossing up just how long it stays in Australia. Here's a reminder of what Terry O'Brien had to say.
But if you look at our business, it's roughly, a base rate is roughly about 30% below Australia.
That's the base hourly rate of the factory workers.
Mm. And then the out-of-hours imposts, such as the shift allowances and overtime premiums, etc., if they exist at all, are quite minor. So that means that a company in our business, say in the vegetable business, who's running during the season and running 24 hours, they have very little difference between the hourly rate of a person working 10 o'clock at night to a person working at 10 o'clock in the day.
That's Terry O'Brien, the managing director of Simplot. They're responsible. That's a company responsible for brands like Edgell and Birdseye. If you're interested in more of what Terry had to say, that entire interview is up on the Bush Telly website. Well, we thought we'd bring you the view from across the Tasman, see what people are saying over there. To get that view, I'm joined by Professor Paul Spoonley, who's from the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Massey University in Auckland, and also Chas Muir, who is Strategic Industry Lead with New Zealand's Service and Food Workers Union. Gentlemen, thank you for joining Bush Telegraph. Paul, I'll start with you. Do you expect to see more Australian manufacturers moving to New Zealand?
Yes, I do. I mean, for one reason, that the cost of labour is so different this side of the Tasman compared to the other. But there's also others. I mean, I'm actually involved in the fruit industry. I've got an orchard in Hawke's Bay, and it's not simply about the cost of labour, but it's one important factor.
What are the other factors?
Management. I mean, if you look at apple production, then per hectare, a New Zealand orchardist will produce double what an Australian orchardist. So there's a cost factor there. It's good management. There's on-orchard costs and off-orchard costs, which are quite low in New Zealand compared to most other orchard-providing countries. And there's a very good scientific base to innovation in the industry. So, and of course, there's the climate. I mean, let's not forget climate. When you look at Australian production, climate is a big factor. It is a factor here, but it's more a major contributor to continuity in production rather than sort of a drought this year or whatever. So we've got access to very good quality water in an aquifer, and we can water all year round, and it really helps a lot.
Chas Muir, what do you think? Do you expect to see more Australian jobs lost to New Zealand?
Well, I think there is that serious threat because we've seen it happen over the years. I mean, we've seen 350 well-paid Australian jobs dissolve and the production come from Heinz Waddy's, from Heinz into Heinz Waddy's in the Hawke's Bay here at... we only gained about 40 jobs, and they were casuals on employed through precarious labour through a third-party labour hire company. So we're not getting we're getting work over here, but they're not good jobs.
Surely, a job is better than no job.
A job on a living wage is better than no job. We have. Tragically, real poverty in New Zealand. We've got a minimum wage here that is a present $13.75, which would equate to $12.86 Aussie. It's going up on the 1st of April this year to $14.25, which is only $13.33 Aussie.
Which is well below ours, 16, just over 16 an hour is minimum wage here, so well below that.
Yeah, $16.35 yours is, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
So, but what we've got here in New Zealand is we've got a very low wage economy, and that is a problem. It's not only a problem for Australian workers and a threat to their jobs, it is also a problem for New Zealand workers. We've got 280,000 children in New Zealand living in poverty, and two out of every five children come from families where at least one of those parents are in full-time work.
Paul,
that equates, so that you know how bad it is, that equates to one in 10 Pākehā, and Pākehā means white European Kiwis, one in five Maori, and one in five Pacific Island households. So it's a really bad problem.
Paul Spenley, what's the history of this? Why is labour so much cheaper in New Zealand compared to Australia?
Well, it began with a 1984 Labour government, which started to deregulate the New Zealand economy. But in terms of the labour market, the government that came in, the Conservative government, the National Party, came in 1990, and the 1991 Employment Contracts Act really sets the tone for New Zealand. And while the Labour government, after 2000, ratcheted that back and brought in a bit more employer protection, more recently we've seen a continuation of the deregulation of labour in this country, so that collective union bargaining, the pay rates and how they're set, the encouragement of flexible work environment, which can be both a positive and a negative. And the most recent, well, one of the most recent examples is the 90-day trial where a worker can be it applies to certain workers, but a worker can be dismissed without any possibility of a grievance being taken against the employer. So if you look at the labour market overall, what we've seen is a shift out of what I would call standard work to non-standard. So the contract worker, the third-party employed worker, the casualised worker, all of those now are dominant in the New Zealand labour market and make up the bulk of employment contracts in New Zealand.
So when we hear companies in Australia saying New Zealand has a more flexible workforce, that's correct?
Yes, it is. It's in terms of the power of unions on either side of the Tasman and the recognition they're given by governments and by employers, it does tend to be quite different. And we've seen one or two examples recently of contrasts, and I would pick the example of Qantas versus Air New Zealand, where you've got quite different employment practices occurring, and certainly in the broader sense, the New Zealand labour market is more flexible than the Australian.
Mm. Do you think it's brought industry to New Zealand?
Yes, because of cost, labour costs. The interesting comparison is that if you compare labour costs across the Tasman, you're typically talking a difference of between a quarter and a third, depending upon what you're counting. But if you go into somewhere like production and look at plant and plant operators, then the difference can be up to 60%. In other words, a worker in Australia will get up to 60% more than a worker in Australia. So if you're talking about food production, for example, then the cost, the labour costs on this side of the Tasman, tend to be considerably lower.
Mm-hmm. Chaz, so if we look at Australian food manufacturers, penalty rates, rostered days off, things like this are generally accepted. A penalty rate's quite a rare thing or an unusual thing now for a New Zealand worker.
No. We have them in, we have collective employment agreements. We do have penal rates. We have shift allowances. We have all that over here. One of the big problems is, as Paul quite rightly touched on, is the increased use of precarious labour. Those are casual workers employed through labour hire companies. In Australia, you have loading on those sorts of workers, and therefore they can be an expensive option. Here in New Zealand, they are totally the reverse. They're very often employed on the minimum wage and are very usable and exploitable. They won't say boo to a goose because they don't want to risk not being called upon to work in a particular site the following day. And for that reason, a lot of them are too afraid to join a trade union. And that is part of the bigger picture problem. That is providing employers with a cheap, exploitable workforce.
But do you agree, in agriculture and food manufacturing in particular, a casual workforce, an affordable casual workforce, is critical for a company, for a business to be viable?
Flexibility is one thing. Flexibility can be achieved with the provision of appropriate clauses in a collective employment agreement, but there's no excuse whatsoever for paying the sort of appalling wages that are being paid in New Zealand. You might not be aware in Australia, but in New Zealand here, we have a living wage movement, and that is groups of community groups, religious groups, and trade union groups, all speaking in one voice, asking for the living wage to be adopted. And the living wage has been assessed by independent analysis, and it's currently sitting on $18.80 an hour, and that is the amount of money that a worker could be expected to earn and live with dignity. So we have a whole swathe of New Zealand workers living in poverty.
So how, as a union, do you plan to maintain or improve productivity, yet improve wages and conditions?
Well, it's part of the money-go-round, isn't it, really? If employers pay decent wages, then workers have got enough money to go into shops and buy stuff and buy their product. So it's a win-win situation. To drive down wages encourages poorly provided for workers. Often they're often sick very often. Their ability to recruit and retain them is impaired because they're always going to be looking for a dollar or so more somewhere else. So the whole thing about not paying a decent wage is spiralling the wrong direction for both workers and employers.
But the problem we seem to have in Australia, one of the problems we seem to have in Australia at the moment, is that much of the food manufacturing industry competes with imported product, an imported product that has cheaper labour as part of its input components. So how does an export-orientated business, or a business that is going to compete with other cheaper producing countries, manage to realise those wage rises for its workers without forcing the company out of business?
Two responses for that. Number one is what we would want to happen as far as wages in New Zealand are concerned is for them to migrate to the same rate as Australian ones. So it shouldn't be a race to the bottom. And secondly, I do believe that consumers like to buy product if they know that it's been properly processed and manufactured in clean and safe factories by decently paid workers. I don't think consumers would sit comfortably with cheap food coming in from the third world where it might have been fertilised by a whole range of unsatisfactory options as far as New Zealand and Australian consumers are concerned. So really, it's not a case of race to the bottom here. It's a case of producing food for our consumers and also providing a decent standard of living for the workers who actually process the food.
Paul, if I can just go to you for the final word. Australia's looking at the moment at a review into working conditions, looking at things like penalty rates and union influence in the workforce. What lessons should Australia take from the New Zealand experience?
Well, it rather depends on your political point of view. I mean, what we've heard is a strong union point of view, and if you talk to Phil O'Reilly from Business New Zealand, you know, he would say this is the changes that have been made are the best thing because it produces flexibility. The flexibility, however, for an employer might be a good thing, but for flexibility when it comes to work certainty, precarious I think is the word that's been used, when your work tips over into being precarious, then it has a number of negative functions for the employee.
I could name you a list of Australian workers in the food manufacturing industry that say their work prospects are precarious at best at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't doubt that. And I mean, I've been looking at some of the Australian stats, and they definitely are precarious, and there are downstream consequences. I mean, you know, look at something terrible like suicides amongst farmers. I mean, you know, there's some really negative consequences there. So I think there is a model, and I would tend to look towards Scandinavia and Northern Europe. The flexicurity model, so it combines security with flexibility. New Zealand has tended to be produce flexibility without the security. So employment protection, work conditions, labour rates, wage rates are not very good at the moment here. And the debate, as you've heard, has been about a living wage and about the level of inequality between top and bottom in New Zealand. It's not common, you know. It's other societies are also experiencing that at the moment. So, maintaining your competitiveness, but without losing the conditions which produce safe, satisfactory, well-paid work, is the challenge in terms of a globalised environment in which you're inevitably competing with very low-wage economies around the world. I mean, New Zealand has been described as low wage, but of course there are other countries which are much have much lower wages than us, and so we in turn have to compete with them.
Yeah, Paul, look, thanks for today. Nice to get your thoughts. Professor,
thank you very much.
Professor Paul Spoonley from the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Massey University in Auckland. And earlier you heard from Chas Muir, Strategic Industry Lead at New Zealand's Service and Food Workers Union. This is Bush Telly. Time now to get the latest in rural news. Tony Allen's with me for today's Rural News. And Tony, you're starting looking at New Zealand today as well. New Zealand is losing interest in lamb.
Yes, well, New Zealand is practically synonymous with sheep. And strangely enough, though, the New Zealanders are moving out of lambs into dairying. And that's good news for Australian lamb producers. Australian lamb producers have been told the price for lambs is expected to increase and to stay strong. There's a shortage of supply of lambs all around the world. And Australia and New Zealand, this is a rare market where Australia and New Zealand can control things. We provide over 90% of the lamb available for export in the world. Tim McRae from Meat and Livestock Australia says New Zealand production of lamb is shrinking and is at its lowest in 60 years.
They're going dairying because that's where the returns are. The government has put a lot of free trade agreements in order. We're focused on being able to build that dairy industry, and it's paying dividends for dairy producers. So the land can be used for many things, and in New Zealand they're swaying towards dairy production and away from sheep and beef, which from an Australian point of view is good to see. Of course, one of our main competitors in lamb particularly is decreasing their ability to compete.
I know when Bush Telegraph was in New Zealand, what was it, more than a year ago, 2 years ago now, it was dairy cows everywhere, a lot more cows than sheep. In Australia now, the fishing industry in the Gulf of Carpentaria is hoping for some good falls in the next cyclone.
Yes, most people don't like cyclones, but given that there's a drought in Queensland, it will have a silver lining if tropical cyclone Gillian brings heavy rain, particularly to inland. The cyclone's coming down through the Gulf, and it's flushing. Hopefully, it will flush out the rivers to provide food for the fish inland and out to sea. The barramundi season has been very poor so far because of the drought. There's already a shortage of barramundi, and some barramundi processors are having to buy imported barramundi, which is a bit ironic given that it's an Australian fish. Gary Ward from the Gulf of Carpentaria Commercial Fishermen's Association hopes the cyclone can turn the season around.
it's not all over yet. We've got another low in the Gulf at the moment, so hopefully that will bring some more rain to some of the rivers. Some of the rivers have had a flush out, but unfortunately it hasn't done anything to move the fish. They're just not feeding. I mean, the fish we're getting have no food in their gullet at all.
It's amazing once you start asking how much barramundi sold in Australia is imported from Asia in particular. It's quite a large amount. I've heard plans before for vertical city farms, but I haven't heard of underground farming before. What's being planned?
Yeah, well, it's not just being planned, it's happening. Farmers in the middle of London have headed 30 metres underground to grow crops.
Mm-hmm.
They've fitted out old World War II air raid tunnels with hydroponic setups. They're growing herbs and lettuce to supply consumers and trendy restaurants in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing, and the company doing it is called Zero Carbon Food, and Stephen Dring from that company says they've faced a number of challenges, both practical and cultural.
We went to Transport for London that sort of owned these tunnels and said we want to put a farm down there, and they thought we were growing weed or were mental, and they still gave us the keys. And yeah, we went down there, started using sort of just a simple one light and one simple hydroponic system. The results were amazing, so we kind of scaled up from there.
Yeah, they use LED lights, which they reckon are very similar to sunlight, and it's working quite well.
So a chef in the middle of London can really get local tomatoes, just pop downstairs.
Yes, yes. Mm. You have to make sure that customers know it's not from the sewers, it's from the air raid shelter.
Interesting stuff. Thanks a lot, Tony. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. You can stay up to date right throughout the day, abc.net.au/rural. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Cameron Wilson with you. You're on RN.
Saturday Extra aired an illuminating take on economic distortions having a devastating impact on our deep oceans. Here's The Economist's John Parker.
The catch is worth $40, and the subsidies just on the fuel alone are something more like $50 or $60. So you're spending $50 or $60 on fuel to catch $40 worth of fish. Now that is completely crazy.
And there was quite a lot more, so listen at your leisure by downloading from the website.
Picture the Lake Eyre Basin. What comes to mind? Maybe vast salt plains with cracking white soil and the occasional shrub? Well, it's hardly the place that you imagine a huge weed problem, but nothing could be further from the truth. And controlling weeds over a combined area the size of Italy, Germany and France makes for a hugely expensive problem. That's why a team from the CSIRO and various unis got together to identify the most cost-effective weed control strategies. And they've come up with 12 possible plans that could manage invasive plants in the basin. Dr. Jennifer Fearn is a visiting scientist at the CSIRO Climate Adaptation Flagship. Jennifer, welcome to Bush Telly.
Thank you, Cameron.
How big is the weed problem in the Lake Eyre Basin?
The weed problem in the Lake Eyre Basin is a big problem, particularly in the semi-arid regions, but also in the arid regions of the Lake Eyre Basin. To give you an idea, the project that we've been working on, where we brought stakeholders together from across the basin, they predicted that in the next 50 years, 57 million hectares of the basin could be occupied by weeds.
57 million hectares? I can't even get my head around that amount of land.
Yes, yeah, the total area is approximately 120 million hectares. So it's a large portion of the basin that is potentially susceptible to weeds.
Which weeds are the problems?
In Australia, we have over 20 weeds of national significance, and most of them are actually found in the Lake Eyre Basin. So some of the biggest problems, actually 10 of the key strategies that were defined in this study identify specific weeds, and that includes prickly acacia, mesquite, and those are weeds of national significance, also Parkinsonia, and also a couple of weeds that are not problems yet, but experts felt that they could become problems into the future, such as mother millions and also chinny apple.
Okay. How do the weeds change the landscape? Apart from the obvious that you can see them there, what else do they do?
What weeds do, and these weeds, for example, prickly acacia, tends to dominate the grasslands of the Lake Eyre Basin, which occupy large expanses or shrublands. In the grasslands, highly productive grasslands like the Mitchell grasslands, they will change the entire structure of those communities, changing them into shrublands. So moving from a grassland to a shrubland, you get a complete change in function, and that includes nutrient cycling, water flow, and also the productivity of the grass, which people are dependent on for farming.
How are these weeds spreading?
These weeds are spreading various ways, partly through people, partly through many of them were intentionally introduced because they honestly felt they were going to be a benefit for communities, but then it turned out they didn't. They were actually not a difficulty controlling them and stopping them into spreading into areas where they weren't intentionally introduced or weren't wanted. They also can spread through floodwaters. They can spread through vehicles, and that is a major component for their spread, and also with animals as well.
You're hearing from Dr. Jennifer Fern, a visiting scientist at the CSIRO's Climate Adaptation Flagship, and we're talking about weeds in the Lake Eyre Basin. Angus Emmett is a grazier in the basin, also a zoologist with four species named after him. Angus, I think it's a turtle, a lizard, a bird and a cicada, isn't it?
That's correct. I've got a couple of extras since then too. But,
oh, really? What have you added?
I named a, in conjunction with the Queensland Museum and Museum Victoria, I named a dragon recently, but I've also got another cicada and another gecko and a plant, a solanum.
A plant as well?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've been busy?
Yes. Oh, well, it's a pretty good part of the world to live in with regard to biology, zoology, because there's been so little work done.
Where exactly are you, Angus?
I'm in the top end of the Queensland Channel country. I'm on the Thompson River, about halfway between Longreach and Windora. And as people may know, the Barcoo and the Thompson Rivers join just above Windora and form Cooper's Creek, Australia's largest creek.
Mm, you've been on the program once before, I think, talking about the beauty of Cooper's Creek. How much land are we talking about that you keep an eye on there?
Well, we've got 50,000 hectares here. I think that's 500 square kilometres. Jenny was just saying about floodwaters being one of the vectors, and that's something we always struggle with. We've got the Thompson River and the Virginian Channels, so about half of our country goes underwater in a big wet year, which we're hoping might happen again shortly. Yeah. And Parkinsonia is one of the prime weeds that we have to deal with year in and year out here.
So at the moment, how bad is the weed situation on the property?
It's not bad at the moment because, well...
No floods, no flood.
Well, we've just had a little bit of rain, thank goodness, after 2 years of no rain, so it's greening up a bit, and there will be a few Parkinsonias we've got to deal with. But right at the moment, because of the very dry conditions, the Parkinsonia is not too bad, and we've got very little in the way of other weeds. We've got prickly acacia, which we've cleaned up, and just keep our eye out all the time for anything that might be coming in. We're very, very aware of cactus, because there's quite serious cactus infestations around Longreach that they've been dealing with very successfully up there, but cactus is a really nasty one because it's just so hard to clean up.
How do you get rid of it?
Well, you've got to spray it all over, but every tiny little nodule that sticks in the side of a tyre or in your trousers or in a kangaroo or a beast leg, away it goes and it just takes off again. And I think an example of just how tough cactus is, up near Longreach, they pulled off a couple of the nodules off the cactus and tied some wire around them. Tied them on the side of a shed in the sun for 2 years and then threw them on the ground and they grew.
2 years later, they were still ready to go.
Yep.
Jennifer, it's in some ways, that's impressive, isn't it?
It is. It's quite remarkable. Plants are amazing.
Angus there points out that the problems after a rain and floods in particular, there has been a bit of rain in some parts of the basin recently. Is that the real problem time in your eyes?
Definitely. That is the real problem time with weeds across the country. Coming out of long periods of droughts, we know that weeds have the capacity to hang around in the seed bank for long periods of time, particularly shrubs like Parkinsonia, prickly acacia and mesquite, and cacti as well.
And Jenny, if I could just add to that, with this extreme drought, and I think the restrictions are a lot greater in South Australia, but there's not really any restrictions in Queensland, there's been huge amounts of fodder moving around. And
yes,
the amount of seed in that and what's going to come up will be feeling incredible, I think.
Okay, so it's obviously handy and needed for the graziers that receive the fodder, but that's the on the bad side, you end up with the weed seeds travelling around the place as well. We've got a tweet just coming in, at RN Bushtelly from Liz. Liz says, weeds can indicate what soil needs, and another cause of weed infestation is monoculture. How does monoculture add to the weed problem, Jenny?
Well, monocultures can add to the weed problem by allowing for there to be increased nutrients and increased water availability for other species to come in and take over. So a really diverse community, if a community was originally very diverse, it likely has a lot of different sources of resources for that a plant might need. So if you're developing a monoculture, there might be excess nutrients, and a weed can capitalize on that because weeds tend to be species that are very opportunistic.
Mm. Angus, how much time do you actually spend on weed control? I know you obviously run an operation there, but how much of it is dedicated to wiping out weeds?
Well, we don't spend a lot of time here because we do have it fairly well under control. But just to give you an example, over the river from us is a property that way back in the 40s or 50s were given prickly acacia seeds or seedlings as part of a government plan to get fodder crops into the area. And they used to carry water out in kerosene drums on the horses and water them. This is Mitchell Grass Downs block. And that got a really huge go on. It's the biggest, largest it was the biggest and largest infestation sort of south of Longreach on the river system, feeding into the river system. And with the local land care group, with Desert Channels, which is the local NRM group, with the local graziers, with the people that owned the place, I think over a period of 15 years, we probably put nearly $1 million into controlling it.
$1 million, gee, that's an expensive problem. Jennifer, what's the solution then? What should be done around the Lake Eyre Basin to try to reduce the problem and, I guess, eliminate those weeds that's possible to do?
Well, as you mentioned, it's a really complex problem and it's such a large area. But as Angus was mentioning, when it is an area where landholders up the road can impact on people down the way in bioregions, can impact on other bioregions. So with this project, what we wanted to do was to bring together stakeholders from across the Lake Eyre Basin that included landholders, local governments, regional government, and also state government. And we want to ask them, well, what are the biggest problems? What do you think we should do, and what are the potential benefits for biodiversity, but also co-benefits for agriculture? Mm. And what came out of that, I think, which was really interesting, was that many of them felt at different stages along the way they could have controlled some of these weeds or had the opportunity to get a hold of them, but then funding would stop. And that weed would have, again, we'd have another rainfall opportunity, maybe some floods, and that weed would take hold again.
Angus, you're out of sight, out of mind. I guess that's the problem when it comes to getting the money, the funding.
Well, I think that is part of the problem, and there's just so many different calls on funding across the nation, of course. But it is money well spent, as Jenny said, if you can actually identify an emerging problem and deal with it harshly and get rid of it before it gets a go on. That can save huge amounts of money later. So it's a matter of being strategic about it. But we do need some form of funding that we can actually seriously throw at any emerging problems before it becomes something that's intractable.
Mm, so it's an economic problem as well as an environmental problem. Jennifer, all the best with your work. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Jennifer Fearn, who's a visiting scientist at the CSIRO Climate Adaptation Flagship. And Angus, always nice to have you on the program. All the best.
My pleasure.
Angus Emmett, who's a grazier in the Lake Eyre Basin. Cameron Wilson with you for Bush Telegraph around Australia on RN and across Asia and the Pacific on Radio Australia. There's a new sound that's coming from the Central Australian desert. That earthy, grungy sound of indigenous desert rock is getting something of a makeover. The Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association has joined up with a Melbourne-based record label to create the sound, so let's hear it. This is the title track from the Chintu Desert Band, and it's called Jammu Kunura. The The track's Gemma Gunnura from the Chintu Desert Band. Let's find out more about this new desert sound. Miko Smith is the head of music at Karma and he's in Alice Springs. Tim Cole is with him. Tim was a member of Not Drowning Waving. He's also a producer. He's known for working with artists like Shelley Morris. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. How's my pronunciation, Miko, of that song title?
Yeah, not too bad. Gemma Gunnura is a Luritja phrase. It means grandfather's country.
Okay, Chintu Desert Band, whereabouts are they from?
They're from Kintore, which is on the border of WA and NT, and Haast Bluff or Nankaricha.
So fairly remote part of the country, I imagine.
Yeah, Kintore's about 6 hours' drive, I think.
Six from Alice.
Yeah, yes. From Alice. So, that's right out there.
Yeah, so how difficult is it to work with a group that's that remote? How do you come across them and work with them?
Well, these guys are really special people. They do a lot of travelling to make all this stuff happen. We've done stuff in their centralised community in Haast Bluff, but also a lot of things in Alice Springs. But, yeah, we just have to organise things really well. Mobile phones and internet aren't really available out there, so we have to stick to timelines and deadlines and really move on them and hope that everything's working.
Yeah. Okay. Tim, what's your role in all this?
I've been employed at Karma Music as the in-house sound engineer producer, so working with the bands, recording, mixing, producing the music.
So I imagine these are a lot of bands that would it be fair to say don't have a lot of experience in a studio like you would have had in the past, your music experience?
I guess it depends how many times they've been in. No, I mean, not as much experience. I've been doing this for a few years, but they're pretty good at it now. Chintu have had a lot of sessions and overdubs and working. We've put a lot of work into producing this album.
Mm. What sound are you going for, though? What are you trying to achieve?
Definitely, you look at what's unique about a sound, about a band, an artist, and say where they're from is something that's unique. Language. And the stories of the songs, but this working with the sound to make it sound like it's from place. So if you can picture the band out there rehearsing, so we do things like dirty up the sounds a little bit. Say the hi-hats, we might then run them through a guitar amp and then sneak that into the sound, just to add a bit more edge to it.
Mm. Why is it important for the sound to be dirty, so it has that sense of place?
Creating something unique, it actually has that already. When you go and listen to the music out there, that the desert reggae does have this sort of rockier, stronger, more sort of bold, confident sound to it than, what you might say saltwater reggae.
Mm.
So it's more about, and there's adding a bit more, intensifying that a bit, bring that idea across a bit more.
So, Miko, there is a definite desert sound.
Definitely. Yeah, some bands now are branching off into other things with the advent of technology and access to more resources. But there's been a sound in the desert for around 30 years, which stems from Bob Marley and Lucky Dube, which is this reggae. But it's not island reggae. It's been sped up about four times. It's similar sort of parts, but it's normally talking about in their local language, is talking about the land or love or stories in culture about looking after places or respecting things and that knowledge that's been passed on. But the sound itself, with that mix of language and that sped-up reggae, yes, we call it desert reggae, and it's been around for 30-something years.
But what is it about reggae? Why did reggae really take hold in the desert, the Australian desert?
It does sound strange, and I don't have a real answer for that. But it's a strange phenomenon, but it's a way of expression. I think that they've picked up. There's been other people around the world that have expressed a story through that, and they've seen that just as a media, and followed it through. I guess, it's kind of strange because we do have desert reggae here within Central Australia, which goes into all states and territories around Alice Springs. But also there's saltwater reggae, as Tim mentioned, which is more in the top in Queensland and around the top of the Northern Territory and the top of Western Australia. It's a similar sound, but it's more islandy. It's more saltwater. It's more flowing. Mm. Here is a more rigid sound and... Yes, I'm really not sure how the reggae started, but it is a very interesting story.
Tim, have you been a reggae fan in the past?
I sort of came through the punk scene where all those reggae influences in the Police and the Clash, and I do remember sitting with Bart Willoughby from No Fixed Address, and he was telling the story when he first heard Catch a Fire, Bob Marley. He said, "This is the music I want to play," and that We Have Survived was one of the first anthems to come out.
Mm-hmm. Well, this new desert sound that we're calling it's featured with the Chinto Desert Band that we've played one track from already. Miko, can you suggest another that we should play?
Yeah, look, another song off this new album, which was released last week, is Guppy, which means water. And it's really a great experience we had last year at the Mbantua Festival. These guys headlined on the Saturday night.
Yep.
After...
Jessica Malboy?
I think so. Yeah. And Guppy is actually a song about the old men in the community saying when the rain will come and which direction it's coming from and what it's all about and what the value that is to the community. Because being in the desert, you know, when it does rain, it's a very special moment. And what actually really happened on that evening was it started to rain halfway through the track. and it came from the west. It was exactly perfect. As the guys were singing. And we've had people come in to us who are from that language group and have said, that was amazing. There was someone there, there was something there. There was a spooky feeling after that. Everyone had goosebumps and it was just an amazing, amazing thing to happen.
All right. Miko, thanks for telling us all about it. Miko Smith, the head of music at Karma, and Tim Cole, former member of Not Drowning Waving, now working in production with this new release. This is Chinto Desert Band. Chinto Desert Band, and the track is Guppy. The track's Guppy, new from the Chinto Desert Band from the album Jamakunora. For the past 12 months, farmers in much of Queensland and New South Wales have been struggling with drought, but it seems they're not the only ones. Across the Pacific, Californian irrigators are suffering through the worst drought in decades. While Australia debates appropriate levels of government assistance for drought-affected farmers here, the chief economist at the US Department of Agriculture, Joe Glauber, says there'll be little direct assistance for farmers in his country. Dr. Glauber has been in Australia speaking at the annual ABARES Commodity Outlook Conference, where he caught up with our reporter, Anna Vito.
The drought is the worst drought in California probably since the 1970s or so. California obviously is a lot like Australia in the sense that it's a limited period of a rainy season, and essentially what water is there is stored in reservoirs, and all the reservoirs are at pretty low levels. So the big issues now are water allocation issues in terms of how much do producers get, and then what decisions they'll make, whether or not they'll use the water for say tree crops or rice production or other things, or will they sell their water rights, which they're under some jurisdictions are able to do. And I think generally we don't know much yet. I mean, there's still a few weeks left in the rainy season, although I think most of the projections are you would really need a lot of rainfall to make up the shortage that we now see, and so no one's really anticipating that. But I think generally, I think we're probably see a lot less rice grown in California this year. Some of that will be made up elsewhere in the U.S., Arkansas and the sort of southern areas, the so-called Mississippi Delta region. We'll see more rice production there for even some of the short grain, medium grain varieties. But the real issue for me, I think in looking at it, will be what will be the impact on fruit and vegetable and tree nut production. California, as you probably know, is the number one agricultural state in the U.S., and it accounts for about a third of vegetable production and about two-thirds of fruit and tree nut production. And, in fact, if you were to go to tree nuts, it's probably 80% of tree nut production. And I think it's clear for producers who have a little bit of water, they're going to want to maintain it on trees and other things that are more perennial in nature. But the impact, I think, unfortunately, we just don't know yet until we see what the allocations are. But it is a very serious drought, and, they're essentially a lot of it will how it gets mitigated will largely be through these allocations. And
of course, drought is something that Australian farmers are very familiar with, and even at the moment we're grappling once again with how to assist farmers, or whether or not we should assist farmers who are struggling with drought. What is the US administration's attitude towards drought assistance for these farmers?
Well, what the US has had over an extended period of time is an insurance scheme for producers. Now, California is more unique than other areas. A lot of these insurance products were developed essentially for row crop, broad acre producers that in the Midwest, less so for specialty crop producers in California. And the insurance is predicated on available water supplies. So if there's not enough water to plant, they won't get insurance. We don't allow them to insure for that. It's only if after the insurance period closes, when they sign up for insurance, if there's a decision at that point to cut off water, then they are eligible for a loss. So I think a lot of these producers, the decisions for allocations will come before the insurance kicks in. So they probably won't be covered there. What the Department of Agriculture is doing, however, is they are looking at some programs on, we have programs to encourage water conservation and to encourage water management, other sorts of
efficiency projects.
Efficiency projects, exactly. And we have our minister was just in the Central Valley talking to producers about freeing up some of those funds to perhaps address some of the issues that way. Now, of course, that's not immediate relief. It's not, but hopefully it helps over the longer run.
Dr. Joe Glauber is the U.S. Agriculture Department Chief Economist, who's speaking there to Anna Vito. Just before we finish for today, can I remind you that later in the week, Bush Telegraph will be coming to you from Tasmania for 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday. On Wednesday, we'll be taking a detailed look at the state of the Tasmanian economy and discussing what might need to change to make sure that state has a more prosperous future. We'll be analysing the state of the education system in Tasmania at the moment and also seeing what agriculture and the wine industry can offer for the years ahead. Then on Thursday, that will be followed by a look at the Tasmanian Forestry Agreement and the contentious World Heritage Area extensions in particular. We'll be broadcasting from Huonville, a town that's had a rich timber past but is changing dramatically. So that's all coming up later in the week on Bush Telegraph, looking at Tasmania ahead of that state election. Stay on RN. News is next, then The World Today.